On the show today, African heads of state are in Russia, meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin and making the case for peace.
He reiterated his position that Ukraine and the West has started the conflict long before Russia sent its armed forces over the border in February last year. He said Russia had never refused talks with the Ukrainian side, which had been blocked by Kyiv.
Plus, some Yazidi refugees are headed home.
With support from the Iraqi Interior Ministry and the International Organization for Migration, members of this historically persecuted minority hope their return will encourage the government and aid groups to provide adequate services.
And later, is Pakistan headed for default? We get the details from Islamabad. Today is Monday, June 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in downtown Washington, I'm Steve Karish. We begin today talking about diplomacy, a push by African heads of state to end Russia's war in Ukraine, and the Prime Minister of India's upcoming visit to Washington. But first, the United States and China have failed to overcome their most serious disagreements, but were able to discuss them in a potentially constructive way and have agreed to continue talks. This according to U.S. and Chinese officials on Sunday. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken began talks in China on Sunday. It's the highest level trip by a U.S. official in nearly 5 years, as the two powers look to turn down the temperature in an escalating rivalry. Both sides have voiced guarded hope of improving communication and preventing conflict. With the world's two largest economies at odds on an array of issues from trade to technology and regional security. Blinken earlier said he would seek to avoid miscalculations and to responsibly manage relations with the country that U.S. policymakers across party lines identify as the greatest challenge to Washington's global primacy. The United States and China are at odds over a slew of issues, including trade, technology, and Taiwan. Beijing has not ruled out seizing Taiwan by force and has conducted military drills near there twice since August. Ahead of Blinken's visit, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said the United States needs to respect China's core concerns and give up the illusion of dealing with China from a position of strength. Beijing has been especially irritated by Biden's restriction on the export of high-end semiconductors to China, with the United States both fearing their military application and eager to prevent the Chinese from dominating next-generation technologies. In a rising domestic priority for the United States, an aide said Blinken is expected to press China to curb chemicals sent to Latin America that are used to produce fentanyl, the powerful painkiller behind an addiction pandemic that kills tens of thousands of Americans a year. Washington has also lashed out at China over human rights, with Blinken's visit the first by a cabinet member since the United States formally accused Beijing of genocide against the mostly Muslim Uyghur minority. Hua Chunying is Chinese Assistant Minister of Foreign Affairs. She said in a tweet that she hopes that this meeting can help steer the U.S.-China relations back to what the two presidents, meaning U.S. President Joe Biden and China's Xi Jinping, agreed upon in Bali, referring to their meeting during the G20 summit, in which the two leaders agreed to maintain open lines of communication. There's more high-stakes diplomacy going on in St. Petersburg, Russia, where a delegation from Africa is meeting with Vladimir Putin. Reuters' Alex Cohen has that story.
African leaders arrived in St. Petersburg Saturday to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin as part of an effort to mediate in the Ukraine conflict. Here's South African President Cyril Ramaphosa.
And we are here to communicate a very clear message that we would like this war to be ended.
Putin interrupted the remarks to deliver a list of reasons why he believed many of their proposals were misguided. He reiterated his position that Ukraine and the West had started the conflict long before Russia sent its armed forces over the border in February last year. He said Russia had never refused talks with the Ukrainian side, which had been blocked by Kyiv. When the African leaders called for the opening up of the Black Sea to allow them to receive grain shipments, he blamed the West, saying, "The crisis on the global food market is not the consequence of the Russian special military operation in Ukraine. It had started taking shape long before the Ukrainian situation developed. It started because the Western countries, the U.S. and European countries, started unfounded and economically unjustified emission in order to solve their own problems connected with COVID." The African leaders are seeking agreement on a series of confidence-building measures, even as Ukraine last week began a counteroffensive to push back Russian forces from Ukrainian territory they occupy. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky had said after meeting the leaders in Kyiv on Friday that peace talks with Russia would be possible only after Moscow withdrew its forces from occupied Ukrainian territory. Putin said Russia remains open to constructive dialogue.
That's Reuters' Alex Cohen. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi will be in Washington for a state visit on June 22nd, aimed at strengthening ties between the two countries. As Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi, mutual concerns over China's growing assertiveness are bringing India and the U.S. closer together, despite the two countries' differences.
Days before Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi heads to the United States for a state visit, India's foreign minister said the relationship between the two countries has come a long way.
You can look at the technology part of the relationship. You can look at the trade of the relationship. You can look at the political convergence that we have, and you can look at the strategic interest. So I think there's a very compelling case for stronger and stronger India-US relations.
The most compelling case is the rise of China. Modi visits the United States as India's fraying ties with Beijing following a three-year military standoff have prompted New Delhi to work closely with Washington as it seeks to counterbalance an assertive Beijing.
The strategic landscape in the Indo-Pacific has changed very dramatically. And the recognition both in Washington and New Delhi that they need to work ever so closely to stabilize the situation. That strategic clarity has meant that for India, strengthening ties with a like-minded country like the US has become a strategic imperative.
Giving India access to advanced defense technologies and weapons, including co-production of weapons, is expected to be a key takeaway during Modi's visit. Modi is also expected to meet top business leaders amid U.S. efforts to diversify supply chains beyond China in critical areas such as semiconductors. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan told an Indian business forum the effort is to facilitate trade.
A number of the deliverables at that visit are not just bullet points on a page. They are fundamentally designed to remove those obstacles in defense trade, in high-tech trade, in investment in each of our countries.
Modi will also address a joint session of the U.S. Congress. In Washington, Secretary of State Antony Blinken expressed optimism about the visit.
So we are here almost literally on the eve of what we believe will be a historic state visit by Prime Minister Modi, one that will further solidify what President Biden has called the defining relationship of the 21st century.
However, amid shifting geopolitics, the two countries are not always on the same page. India has strongly defended maintaining friendly ties with Russia in the aftermath of its Ukraine aggression. Moscow has become New Delhi's biggest crude oil supplier. Critics have also expressed concerns about democratic backsliding in India. But Modi's visit will build on common interests as the two countries focus on the big picture of countering China.
You know, when the Ukraine war started, there was a lot of concern that it will derail the relationship and the two countries are going in different directions. But the relationship has continued to grow. In fact, it has become more vibrant.
The expectation is that Modi's visit will strengthen a relationship now seen as a win-win for both sides. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
In 2014, the Yazidi minority in Iraq came under assault from Islamic State fighters who drove them from their homes. Now, some refugees are arriving back to their hometowns after years of displacement. VOA's Kawa Omer has the story from Sinjar, Iraq, narrated for us by Sirwan Kejo.
Mishko Khalaf is coming home to Sinjar, Iraq, after living in a displacement camp in Duhok province since 2014. He and his family are part of a new batch of Yazidi families returning this week to the northern Iraqi town, which came under a major assault by the Islamic State terror group in 2014. With support from the Iraqi Interior Ministry and the International Organization for Migration, members of this historically persecuted minority hope their return will encourage the government and aid groups to provide adequate services. Another returnee, Mendy Hassan, says while it is good to be back, she still worries about Islamic State militants.
We are still afraid, but we pray to God that they stay away from here.
While the Islamic State group no longer controls any territory, it continues to carry out occasional attacks against civilians and Iraqi security forces in several parts of the country. Despite such threats, Iraqi officials hope that more Yazidi families will be able to leave displacement camps and return to their homes. Iskender Amin is director of the Iraqi Department of Migration and Displacement in Duhok.
This is the fourth group of people returning to Sinjar recently. Earlier this month, 57 families returned. And this time, nearly 94 families are returning. This process continues in coordination with the International Organization for Migration.
Khalaf says getting assistance is encouraging.
They said that those whose houses have been destroyed would get new ones. Others will have their houses repaired.
While thousands of Yazidis remain in displacement camps across the Kurdistan region, Iraqi officials hope improving the conditions in Sinjar will allow more to return soon. For Kawa Omar in Sinjar, Iraq, Sirwan Kejo, VOA News.
Other stories we're following from around the world? Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Saturday there seems to be no chance of extending the United Nations brokered Black Sea Grain Initiative that allows Ukraine to export grain safely through Russian-controlled waters. Israel's government on Sunday granted a pro-settlement ringleader authority over planning in the occupied West Bank and lifted red tape on the settlement housing approval process. An estimated 400,000 people gathered in Seoul, South Korea on Saturday as fans from around the world commemorated the 10th anniversary of the debut of K-pop boy band juggernaut BTS. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Critical materials, which include rare earth elements, are important in the manufacture of consumer and non-commercial goods and in the development of green energy initiatives. But the U.S. and other countries must import most of these materials from outside sources to maintain a sufficient supply. Researchers at Penn State University are looking into ways of using waste materials from Pennsylvania's many coal mines as a new source of these valuable materials. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, Pennsylvania is the second largest exporter of coal in the United States. An important secondary benefit of using this waste would be to reduce environmental pollution. Penn State is heading a group that will evaluate and list key mineral resources in and outside of Pennsylvania. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
It's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. A look at Pakistan's economy shortly. First, a look at the economies near the tragic conflict in Sudan. Moody's, the International Credit Rating Agency, and the International Monetary Fund say the Sudan conflict will harm its neighbors' economies if it continues. In the markets of N'Djamena, Chad's capital, traders and customers alike have already been feeling the pinch from high inflation. Henry Wilkins reports.
In the markets of N'Djamena, Chad's capital, the economic effects of Sudan's conflict are already being felt. Hot sweet tea, a favourite beverage for many Chadians, has been one of the first casualties. Almost all the country's red tea, so-called for its rich colour, as well as Chad's supply of sugar, are imported from Sudan. Tea seller Abdou Allah Mohamed told VOA he has had to raise prices. He says it's part of the culture, and some people like their tea sweet. Adding that since the fighting started, his business has been affected and the sugar is more expensive. Market trader Idris Adam Ismail said that because no goods have been coming from Sudan since the war started, he now has to buy sugar from Cameroon, which is more expensive, putting even more pressure on his business, already suffering from high inflation. He said that before the conflict, a bag of sugar from Sudan cost about $50, but now it's gone up to around $90. He added that goods are more expensive than people can afford because of the Sudan fighting. He said he wants the fighting to end so that he can continue his business in the best way possible. N'Djamena has a closer trading relationship with Cameroon than Sudan, but analysts say cities in the east of Chad, for which the opposite is true, are suffering the most. The economic impacts of Sudan's war are not confined to Chad. After returning from a recent visit to Cairo, Patrick Heinisch, an emerging markets economist covering the Horn of Africa and Nile Valley at the German bank Helaba, described the economic impact there.
They already say that real estate prices in Cairo have risen because of the influx of Sudanese refugees. They also want accommodation. They're looking for apartments. So this is one of the first impacts. It also depends on how many people will in the future continue to escape to the neighboring countries. So will it really have an impact on overall inflation, for example?
Moody's Investor Service, a US-based credit rating company, has said the Sudan conflict will likely hurt Sudan's neighbors' credit ratings, as well as those of developed banks in the region, while the International Monetary Fund also warns of growing economic impacts as the war continues. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, N'Djamena, Chad.
Pakistan is facing a debt crisis. It must pay billions to service the debt, but the state coffers are almost empty. And at the same time, hopes of reviving a stalled 2019 International Monetary Fund bailout program are fading. Is Pakistan only days away from default? VOA's Pakistan Bureau Chief Sarah Zaman reports from Islamabad.
Glittering gold jewelry, colorful fabrics, delicious street food. In Pakistan's bazaars, this is business as usual. But the country of almost 230 million people is in a debt crisis. Just this month, Pakistan needs to pay back $3.6 billion in external loans. While it has paid some and expects most of it to be rolled over, the government still must find a way to pay $900 million. The state has barely $4 billion in foreign exchange reserves. Economist and former finance minister Hafiz Pasha says a default may not happen this month.
The likelihood of rollover of those payments, particularly by China, is almost certain. In which case, inshallah, we will not default, inshallah, by the end of this month, June.
A revival of a stalled 2019 bailout deal with the International Monetary Fund that would unlock more than $1 billion appears increasingly unlikely. That program ends June 30 with Pakistan's fiscal year. Finance Minister Ishaq Dar says even without the IMF's help, Pakistan will meet its financial obligations. Dar told a media briefing, Pakistan has sovereign commitments which the past government made, and even at the cost of paying a political price, the current government has and must meet those obligations. To save precious dollar reserves, the government has been curtailing imports. Economist Uzma Zia.
I think that was not a good policy because our economy is dependent, our exports are dependent on imports, imported raw material. So when that raw material was not in the country, that was not coming in, the exports were affected too much.
Pakistan's credit rating is already poor. Former Finance Minister Hafiz Pasha says the lack of an IMF deal will rattle the market.
There will be greater instability in the exchange rate and the inflation rate could thereby be also affected.
That means more pain for Pakistanis who are already dealing with a record 38% annual inflation rate. Some experts say, in many ways, Pakistan has already defaulted. Economic analyst Ali Khizr.
You are not letting the payments to go out the country, whether it by dividends or it by people sending for their kids. Many people are sending money outside Pakistan through informally. Many businesses are moving out. Many people are migrating out of the Pakistan. So we haven't really defaulted technically on our debt, but we have defaulted on many grounds.
Pakistan's debt crisis will not end with the fiscal year. Starting in July, the country has to manage nearly $25 billion of external loan repayments over the next 12 months. Sara Zaman, VOA News, Islamabad.
And finally today, as northeastern India faces record heat, thousands in western Indian relief camps can begin returning home as Cyclone Biparjoy recedes. The AP's Karen Chamas has that story.
In the coastal village of Jakhau in Gujarat, many were still stuck in a local shelter, waiting to return home. However, over 130 people had left the shelter so far. After the landfall, the cyclone uprooted trees and electricity poles in hundreds of villages along the coastal regions of Gujarat. Officials said electricity had been restored in many villages, but some were still without power. Local resident Ahmad said the damage to his rental boats was minor, and it could have been worse. Some small boats had been damaged. The storm had wind speeds of up to 53 miles per hour and gusted up to 65 miles per hour through the coastal areas of Gujarat. I'm Karen Chamas.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, visit us online at voanews.com and follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On June 19th, Americans celebrate Juneteenth, a holiday of unique significance to the country's African-American population. The date does not commemorate the day that the Emancipation Proclamation was formally issued. That was January 1st, 1863. Nor does it mark the December 6th, 1865 ratification of the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which finally abolished slavery across the country. Instead, it celebrates the day when the last, most isolated population of formerly enslaved people living on Galveston Island in Texas received the news that they were finally free, June 19, 1865. 1 year later, on June 19, 1866, Juneteenth was first celebrated in Texas, and the festivities soon began to spread across the American South. Today, Juneteenth is considered to be the country's longest-running African-American holiday. It was another 156 years before the importance of the 19th of June, 1865 was officially recognized. On June 17, 2021, President Joe Biden declared Juneteenth to be a federal holiday by signing the Juneteenth National Independence Day Act into law. To me, making Juneteenth a federal holiday wasn't just a symbolic gesture, said President Biden. It was a statement of fact for this country to acknowledge the origin of the original sin of slavery.
To understand, the war was never fought over it. It wasn't just about the Union, but it was most fundamentally about the country and freedom. To remember, the Emancipation Proclamation wasn't just a document. It captured the essence of freedom that galvanized the country. It proved that some ideas are more powerful. They can't be denied. It's a reminder that the promise of America is we all are created equal in the image of God, and we deserve to be treated equally throughout our entire lives.
Juneteenth marks both the long, hard night of slavery and subjugation and a promise of a brighter morning to come.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.